speaking of your opponents, I would imagine foremost on your mind, Anvil, and of course, Brett the Hitman's would be the tag team champions of British Bulldogs.
You're always asking us questions. Right. Well, let me ask you a question, all right?
Be my guest.
What exactly is a female dog?
Answer that one, Brett.
Well, it's called a bitch, is the term.
A what?
Call the terminology is a bitch. We're referring to a female dog.
That's the Bulldog's new manager.
It's bad enough that you gotta take orders from a dog. But you gotta take orders from a bitch.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 311 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for this Royal Rumble Sunday, January 26, 2014. I am the Solid Monster. I'm trying to figure out if Brett was wasted or if Brett was high. Or maybe a combination of both. I can't quite figure it out. All I know is every time I listen back to that promo, I just laugh and laugh and laugh. Ah, the 80s. Days gone by. This week's Sound Off is brought to you by Audible.com. I want to thank everybody who has signed up for their free audiobook and their free 30-day trial of the Audible service. I know many of you seem to be very happy with it so far. You can get a free audiobook right now and sign up for 30 free days of service through Audible. Go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. They've got thousands, tens of thousands of books to choose from, including some wrestling books. You can get it on your iPhone, your Kindle, Android, all kinds of devices. And by doing so, you are helping to support this podcast. And if you are listening to the show, I know many of you like to support this show. So to do so, just go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. You sign up. You don't get billed or anything for 30 days. You can try it out. Get your free audiobook. You're under no obligation, but I think you guys are going to like it. It's a good service. So audibletrial.com/solomonster. Go there right now. I want to also take a moment here to give some PayPal shout-outs, people supporting the show in other ways. Mitchell Montgomery, Joseph Garcia, and perhaps the most difficult name I've ever had to pronounce on this show, and I hope I don't botch this, but here we go. Shanil Yagendranath Misra Mohabir. That's a mouthful. Hope I got that right. You guys are great. Thank you for the donations. If you want to make a PayPal donation to the show, which is always the quickest, easiest, most direct way to support the Sound Off, you can do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the donation box there. You can put in whatever amount that you would like. And that's it. It's that easy. So head over there if you want to make a donation. Okay, now, it is the Royal Rumble this weekend. It comes but once a year. It is probably my favorite pay-per-view of the year. It's right up there with WrestleMania, emanating from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And before I go any further, just a quick note here. For those who signed up for our first-ever Sound Off group Royal Rumble pool on Facebook, Zach Holker has posted the entrance and your corresponding numbers in the pool. I, for example, have drawn number 26, which I am very happy with. So if number 26 should win the Royal Rumble this year, I win the pool. And the winners will get shout-outs here on the podcast. So I guess if I win, I give myself a shout-out, or not. I haven't quite figured out what I'll do yet. Gloat, probably. I think that goes without saying. So anyway, head over to our Facebook group page if you're not already a member. We've had a ton of new people sign up since I mentioned it last week. We're well over 1,000 members now, so if you're not there, head over, send a request, I'll approve you, and you can get in on things like this. I want to thank Zach for setting this whole thing up. Hopefully we'll do another one of these next year. It should be a lot of fun. But again, you can do that on our group page right now on Facebook. Let's run through the card for the big pay-per-view this weekend. We'll start from the bottom and work our way up to the top. First, the Royal Rumble kickoff show is going to feature a tag team championship match. Cody Rhodes and Goldust defending the titles against Billy and Bart. That goes back. That's a different tag team. Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, the New Age Outlaws, getting their first crack at tag team gold. I mean, I don't even know. I'm going to guess the year 2000 would have been the last time they probably wrestled for the tag team titles. So it's been a while. They've looked pretty good on TV of late. They've been on pretty much every show, Raw, SmackDown. They were part of the big 10-man tag main event on SmackDown this week, which was pretty good. I am going to go ahead and predict the New Age Outlaws here. Wouldn't shock me if Cody and Goldust retain, but they built up some friction, which they've started to do heading into the Rumble match. We know that the two of them are going to be pulling double duty, so even though this match is on the pre-show, they will be on the pay-per-view. I don't know about Billy and Road Dogg, but I'm going to go with the Outlaws here, just because it looks to me like they are starting things in motion for a Cody Goldust feud heading into WrestleMania. I outlined a whole plan months ago on how I would book this thing. I'm almost sad, though, because they're such an awesome tag team, and I would hate to break them up this soon. I think the timing with WrestleMania coming up, it's just really poor timing. But if they're going to go in that direction, I would have them drop the belts here, because you can then build up even more tension between them going into the Rumble match. And you put the belts on the Outlaws, it's a nostalgic thing. They wouldn't hold them for that long. And whether it's on Raw one of these weeks, or if you want to keep the belts on them until WrestleMania, at some point between now and then, they drop the belts to a team like the Usos and put them over. I have no problem with that. And it's not like the Outlaws have looked awful in the ring. They're actually passable. They're good. So I don't have a problem putting the belts on them, and I'd probably do it myself. So they're my pick. New tag team champions. Also, the guest panel for the Royal Rumble will consist of all Royal Rumble winners. Hacksaw Jim Duggan, the first Rumble winner, who I think just had surgery, I think laser eye surgery, and he had surgery on his shoulder, I think, to repair his rotator cuff. So he's the bionic man. He'll be there. Nature Boy Ric Flair, winner of the greatest Royal Rumble match of all time in 1992. And Shawn Michaels, back-to-back Rumble winner in 95 and 96. All three men will be on the guest panel. On the pay-per-view itself, not a lot of matches signed. Wouldn't surprise me if they add a Divas match, maybe AJ and Trinity or Naomi, whatever she goes by on television. I don't even know. I don't even know why they have two different names between Total Divas and this show. But it's possible they'll add that. If not, we have a pretty slim card here. Daniel Bryan and Bray Wyatt have their one-on-one match. It certainly looks like Daniel Bryan will not be in the Royal Rumble match, which is just completely ridiculous. He did an interview on Friday with some... It was either a newspaper or a website, but he made it clear that as of that day, he was not in the Rumble match. And he made a comment in there about how Triple H doesn't want me anywhere near the Rumble match. You know, I'm hoping that maybe it's all just a work, and he'll be a surprise entrant, you know. It'd be pretty cool to see him come out there at number 30 and the place goes crazy. Comes down to him and Batista. I would love it just because I am convinced that if the Royal Rumble match were to come down to Daniel Bryan, if he was in it, and Batista, Batista would get drowned out by chance of Daniel Bryan. I mean, Batista would have his fans, but I have no doubt in my mind that the crowd would be firmly behind Bryan over Batista. And whoever wins, it would make for a great visual. I'm sure Batista wouldn't be too thrilled. But it's a moot point. I don't think Bryan is going to be in the Rumble match, and that's a big mistake, in my opinion. The match with Bray, I think Bray's going over either way, especially if you consider the rumored WrestleMania plans. They'll call for a Bray Wyatt-John Cena match. I'm sure they want to keep Bray Wyatt as strong as possible. Bryan has lost before. He will lose again. I don't think it'll harm him too much. If Bryan was going to be in the Rumble, it would actually make total sense to have him lose to Bray Wyatt. You know, kind of the whole Brett Owen deal at WrestleMania 10, where Brett goes out there, opening match, loses to his brother, comes back out at the end and wins the championship. So Owen picks up a big win, which is a big boost for his credibility, and it doesn't hurt Brett, because Brett ends the night with the belt. Kind of a similar thing here, where if Bryan was going to be in the Rumble, you have Bray beat him. And Bryan ends up entering the Rumble later on, and he wins the whole thing. And it almost makes too much sense now that I put it like that, because, and I know they're not doing this, I think any hope of Daniel Bryan wrestling for the championship at WrestleMania is pretty much dead. And we're going to talk about Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania in a second, because I got something to say about that. But if you think about it, if Bryan were to win the Rumble and go on to challenge for the title, I've said before, it makes sense. It's a nice way to wrap up this storyline with the Authority that they began back over the summer and give people a satisfying conclusion that I think a lot of fans have been waiting for. But what you can also do in having Bray beat him it's like, okay, well, Bryan wins the Rumble. Now what does he do between now and WrestleMania? Well, you got one title now. I mean, two belts, but you got one unified championship. So with the Elimination Chamber, the title is determined in the chamber match. So whatever six guys, including the champion, are going to be in the chamber match, they'll be wrestling for the title. And the other big match on the February pay-per-view can be Bryan and Bray in a rematch with Bryan's WrestleMania shot on the line. And I am not a fan of that. I've said that before. I hate that. It's stupid. In the past, when you've had the babyface who won the Royal Rumble and went through hell to get there, all of a sudden, yeah, I'll put my title shot on the line against you. It's completely dumb, but I'm sure they could come up with a storyline explanation for it. You know, Triple H and the Authority, they're always looking to screw Bryan. Well, fine. Have them put Bryan in a match with Bray Wyatt, with the logic being that Bray beat you at the Royal Rumble, and it's only appropriate that he has a chance to win your title shot. Of course, Bryan would win, and then he would go on to Mania. But anyway, this is all, again, fantasy booking. I don't think that's the direction they're going in. I still say Bray Wyatt wins, and it's a shame. It's a shame if Bryan loses the match and doesn't even show up in the Rumble later in the night. They're squandering a huge opportunity here. I don't see the logic behind it, and I disagree with it. I think it's stupid, and I'm holding out a sliver of hope that he will be in the Rumble, but not looking too good right now. We have Brock Lesnar and The Big Show, one-on-one. I'm looking forward to this match maybe more than any other match on this card. I very much enjoy Brock Lesnar matches. I don't typically enjoy Big Show matches. I like Big Show in you know, other ways. He's been good on commentary sometimes. When Big Show does comedy, it can be funny. Not really a big Show fan as far as his matches go, but again, these guys had a chemistry 10, 11 years ago. I know that's a long time ago, but I think they'll have a good match. I don't expect it to be a long match. There's no reason for these guys to be in that ring for more than 5 or 6 minutes, to be honest. And Brock, there's only one outcome for this match. Brock wins. And Brock wins in decisive fashion. It's one thing to have Brock running away from him on television every single week to make Big Show out to be this monster that you should be afraid of. But once they get to the Rumble, you got to have these two guys just go head-to-head. Brock should not be running scared. He just has to go in there. I'm sure Big Show will throw him around and Brock will bump all over the place for him. But then Brock's got to throw Big Show around a little bit. F5 at some point, 1-2-3, and that's it. That's the only outcome for this match that makes sense. So Brock's winning this match, and then hopefully at that point Brock can do us all a favor and go ahead and take care of Justin Bieber. I posted a tweet a couple of days ago, and I meant every word of it. You know, I'm getting sick and tired of seeing all these news stories, even local news. We're not even talking about cable news. You put on the local news. I wake up in the morning to go to work. You watch the 11 o'clock news at night. All you hear about is Justin Bieber. Justin Bieber got arrested. Justin Bieber was drag racing under the influence. And Bieber this and Bieber that. And let me tell you something. You know, Canada's greatest export over here. If Justin Bieber is not reason enough to go to war with Canada, then I don't know what is. I say we use him as a reason to declare war and just wipe him off the map, because this is all their fault. But I mentioned Brock because what all this kid needs, 19 years old, okay? I know he's acting like a kid. He's not the only 19-year-old to do stupid shit. But here's the thing. The kid's a douchebag. And what he needs is a good old-fashioned ass-kicking. And Brock Lesnar is the perfect person to give Justin Bieber that ass-kicking. And it would make for great entertainment. So if somehow they could get Justin Bieber to show up on an episode of Raw, you just book the best segment in the history of Raw. Justin Bieber in the ring with his buddies, making an appearance, threatening to sing for all of us. And then you cue Brock Lesnar's music and let nature take its course. You know, and you just have a little agreement on the side with Brock. Don't worry, we'll bail you out. Everything will be cool. And then, because we know WWE loves their social media, we can kind of integrate social media into this. The next week, you can have Michael Cole on television giving us the hashtag, you know, pray for Justin. So we could all send get well messages on Twitter to Justin Bieber, and his mom can read them to him in his hospital room. I think that's a fantastic idea. Moving on, John Cena and Randy Orton for the WWE World Heavyweight Championship. No DQ, no interference. Hopefully the final Cena-Orton match for some time. I've seen enough of these two together. I'm going with Randy Orton here. I think it's too early to take the title off him. If he's going to be their champion going into WrestleMania, then that's fine. If they're going to switch the title from him to somebody like Brock or somebody like that at the Elimination Chamber, that's fine too. There's no reason to put the title on Cena right now if the belt possibly is going to change hands next month anyway. And I don't really need to see John Cena in the championship match at WrestleMania unless he's got the right opponent. And John Cena, Randy Orton, part 509 is not the answer for WrestleMania. So I'm perfectly content keeping the belt on Orton. Now, they've said no interference. I can't see Randy Orton beating John Cena clean 1-2-3. You know, I think that if they're going to do Cena and Bray Wyatt, this would be an appropriate time to have some Wyatt family involvement that leads to Cena losing the match. But I have no idea what they're going to do. I just know that Orton's got to be keeping the belt here, so he's my pick. And then we have the 30-man Royal Rumble match. I don't remember exactly how many guys they've announced so far. It's in the 20s. They've left open a whole bunch of spots for possible surprises, whether it's somebody like a Bryan or somebody on the outside. As far as, you know, I wouldn't shock me to see RVD in there. Wouldn't shock me at all if they brought in Jake the Snake, which I hope they do, since I know he's been just dying to get in the Royal Rumble match for months and months and months. So for him, probably more so than any of us, it would be a huge deal. You could do the DDT spot with him and Heath Slater or whoever, and have 3MB or have one person just gently dump him over the top rope. No harm, no foul. I could see that. Kevin Nash is in town for some event. Maybe he can put on the diesel gear and give CM Punk another powerbomb. I don't think he gave CM Punk enough of those jackknife powerbombs 2 years ago. Then he can throw him out as a favor to Triple H. And I'm only half joking when I say that, by the way. So we'll see who they have in mind. I always love the surprises in the Rumble. Yeah, I've heard other names, Christian, who's been ready to come back for a while, and you know, maybe Sheamus and stuff like that. We'll find out. I'm sure there's one or two names that none of us are thinking of who will pop up. As far as who wins, that's a good question. I certainly would be led to believe, based on television, that Batista's winning the Royal Rumble, and based on the WrestleMania plans that are floated around out there, and the fact they brought this guy back, a lot of fanfare, signed a 2-year contract, so he's going to be sticking around for a while. He's a big star. You know, I know it's kind of predictable, but Batista is my pick. CM Punk is entering the Rumble at number one. I think he'll probably go all the way to the end, or pretty close to the end. But if it's going to be Punk and Triple H at WrestleMania, I don't see Punk winning the Rumble. I can see him getting screwed. So Batista's my pick. There really is nobody else that makes any sense, if you think about it, based on who's involved in what match. You know, John Cena is not going to be in the Rumble match. Bryan, it appears, is not going to be in the Rumble match. We have The Big Show and Brock doing their thing. Brock's not in the Rumble. You know, no other person, given what we've seen on TV, and we saw a tease on Raw last Monday of Batista and Orton, Batista threatening him and telling him, I'm going to take the title from you at WrestleMania. That would be the direction that would make the most sense. Now, if they want to have a name out of left field, I know Batista's been feuding online, a Twitter war, you know, they keep saying with Alberto Del Rio. I don't see Del Rio winning the Rumble. I just don't see any other logical choice beyond Batista. It would be a name completely out of left field if anybody else won the Rumble. I don't see a Roman Reigns winning the Royal Rumble. It's not the right time. I would hold off on that whole Shield split anyway until WrestleMania. Let that thing work. You know, let that thing work out. They got a good thing going right now. They'll build to something, and Reigns will break out and be this big babyface. Way too early for him to be winning Royal Rumbles or winning the world title or anything like that. I could see Reigns dumping a whole bunch of people out of the ring. In fact, I expect that. And I expect something to go down where one member of the Shield eliminates another, something like that. But Roman Reigns is not even a dark horse pick to me. I just don't see that happening. So Batista's my pick. And that's the card. Like I said, maybe they'll add a Divas match, maybe they won't. I know some people are upset the tag title match is not on the pay-per-view. I'm just kind of over the whole thing. It is kind of dumb. I guess the logic is that maybe they can entice some new buys by putting an exciting match on the pre-show. And look, Cody and Goldust have had some of the most exciting matches on television in recent months. Goldust has been awesome. Cody's great. Cody hangs in there with him, and people are getting into him, I think, a little bit more and more. Goldust still gets bigger reactions from people, I think, more out of nostalgia than anything else. They're just amazed by some of the things he's able to do in the ring. But the point is, you have these two teams, the Outlaws are still kind of over, at least with that older audience, and maybe that's their mentality. They think that they can maybe get some more buys. My logic is this. By 7:45 on Sunday night, you know whether or not you're paying $60 to watch the Royal Rumble. I don't see Cody and Goldust and the Outlaws going out there and changing many people's minds unless Steve Austin comes out and stuns all four of them, drinks beer, and says, order the Royal Rumble because Stone Cold said so. Okay, that might get more people to buy the pay-per-view. Short of something like that happening, I don't think it makes a difference one way or the other. So who cares? I'm sure it'll get the show off to a hot start. I'm looking forward to it. I haven't been excited. I haven't had a reason to be excited for a WWE pay-per-view since SummerSlam. I'm mildly excited for the Royal Rumble, which is more than I can say for Survivor Series and Battleground and all the other BS nonsense that they've spoon-fed us over the last few months. I'm sure the Rumble can't possibly be any worse than that. Now, I mentioned before, Daniel Bryan, WrestleMania, a lot of rumors going around. There's a report online that is, I believe, credited to Mike Johnson over at PWInsider.com, that Daniel Bryan's match for WrestleMania has been penciled in. Nothing is ever set in stone. You never know. Somebody goes down with an injury and plans always change. But it's pretty solid, it sounds like, that Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania 30 is going to go one-on-one with Sheamus. Sheamus has been out since last summer. He had a serious shoulder injury that was operated on. He was teasing only a couple of months ago that the shoulder wasn't healing as quickly, and so he really didn't know when he was going to come back. And a lot of people called BS on that, including myself. I expect to see him at the Royal Rumble, and if not, I'm sure very shortly thereafter he'll be back. I think he's fine, or just about fine. And, you know, it takes me back to a column I did on Yahoo last summer. And I know I plugged it. A lot of you guys read it and gave me feedback on it. If you go back and check, I did a column for Yahoo, and that reminds me, I haven't done one in a while. I gotta come up with something to write about for them. But I did one on how Sheamus' injury could be the best thing that ever happened to him in his career. It could be the best news that he could possibly ask for, because Sheamus was going nowhere. Sheamus was doing nothing last year. He was a bully. He would come out. That whole storyline with Mark Henry, he was a giant dick to Mark Henry. They had, you know, all these different contests, arm wrestling contests, and Sheamus was just a total heel. And Mark Henry, to me anyway, was the babyface. That whole thing was just weird. Then he went into a feud with Cody and with Damian Sandow when they were the Rhodes Scholars. This guy had no direction. And this guy at one time had been the World Heavyweight Champion. So, from Sheamus' point of view, my logic was, he goes away for a while, he comes back fresh, and the guy who put him out of action was Daniel Bryan. They were part of that Money in the Bank ladder match in Philadelphia back in July, and Bryan was the one who knocked him off the ladder and caused Sheamus to suffer an injury. I don't know that they ever acknowledged that on television, but it's in the footage if you go back and watch. Now, I did this article. Let me check the date here. I'm pretty sure it was in August. Yeah, it was August 28th, 2013 is when I did this article. And the argument that I put forth was that Sheamus should come back as a heel. He should come back as a heel on behalf of the authority to go after Daniel Bryan as revenge for Bryan taking away 6 months of his career, 6 months of his life. From a storyline point of view, makes sense. Plus, you know, Sheamus and Bryan have had some great matches before. These two guys have great chemistry. I have no problem seeing Daniel Bryan and Sheamus in a wrestling match because I'm sure that at the very worst, it would be a very good match. And at best, it could be an excellent match. That's not the problem here. What makes this different, and the reason I don't like this news at all, if this is true, is because in the article I did, I argued that it makes sense if Daniel Bryan is the champion. Sheamus comes back on behalf of Triple H and Stephanie, goes after Bryan to take the title away from him. This was back when I thought Bryan, you know, how foolish of me that Bryan might actually have a run with the belt, which he never did. But the whole premise of it was that Bryan would be the champion, and that you could end up with maybe a Sheamus Daniel Bryan championship match at WrestleMania. Now, I know there's going to be a lot of people who laugh at that, who scoff at the notion of that. And it is kind of funny to look back on that now, because Bryan never did get to the level that I thought he was about to get to. They never gave him a real chance. They gave the belt to Orton. They transitioned Bryan into a completely different feud. And it's been Orton who's been headlining all these pay-per-views. And nobody really talks about that either, by the way. There are a lot of people out there who say, oh, Daniel Bryan's not good for ratings, he's not good for pay-per-view buy rates, but they completely ignore the fact that all these pay-per-views that have done terrible business over the last several months. And I guess Hell in a Cell's number wasn't terrible, but that probably had more to do with John Cena coming back. Randy Orton is the common denominator here. Randy Orton has headlined, if you count that cash-in at SummerSlam, every single pay-per-view since August. Beat Bryan for the belt at SummerSlam. Headline with Bryan at the pay-per-view in September. Night of Champions. Battleground. Hell in a Cell. Survivor Series with Big Show, which did terrible business. The unification match with Cena at TLC. I don't know how that show did. But the common denominator here is Orton. Orton's not exactly lighting the world on fire in terms of the business that he's doing. And here he is again at the Royal Rumble, headlining with John Cena. So Bryan never really had a shot at that level to get the title and to just go off on his own and do his own thing. At the time, though, I thought it would make perfect sense. And it would give Sheamus something high profile to do when he came back because he was doing absolutely nothing before he got hurt. Nobody wanted to see him. Nobody liked him. You know, in the column I even pointed out, remember when John Cena picked his opponent for SummerSlam? They had everybody out there on Raw on the stage, and he's going person by person asking the people, well, what do you think of Ryback? What do you think of Alberto Del Rio? And then he gets to Sheamus, who was supposedly like the number two or three babyface in the company at the time. Probably three, behind Punk. Maybe four, if you count Bryan. But he mentioned Sheamus' name, and nobody cared. No, people booed. They had no interest in seeing Sheamus wrestle John Cena for the championship. That's how far that guy had fallen. There were at least some people who used to like the guy. Something must have happened from then to now. So he would come back as a heel. He would go after Bryan. Bryan would already be the champion. And you kind of build it from there. Well, Bryan is not the champion. And Bryan deserves a lot better than essentially a mid-card match on the biggest show of the year. Okay, even if you're not a fan of putting Daniel Bryan in a title match, that's fine. I know there's a lot of people who don't get the love for Daniel Bryan. They think he's too short. They think he's too boring. All he does is kick. He's got no personality. He's awkward on the microphone. It's all very subjective. Fine. If that's how you feel, no problem. You can say, sure, he's not the strongest promo and he's not the biggest guy. No shit. But that doesn't mean the guy doesn't deserve to be in one of the top, let's say, three matches on the show. There are a ton of different guys that you can plug Bryan in there with. What the hell ever happened to the Bryan versus Triple H feud they were teasing? I guess that went the way of the Triple H Big Show feud, the big match that never happened. Bryan and Shawn Michaels, they were teasing stuff with them. I don't know what the hell the point of that was if they weren't going to have Shawn come back and wrestle. Bryan and Cena? That's a rematch I wouldn't mind seeing. Bryan Undertaker? Any of those guys. Bryan and Brock? I pitched that idea before. I could see any of those matches. Bryan and Sheamus for no title, just on the undercard, buried by all of these other matches that they're going to have. There's at least four or five other matches that are going to be higher up on the card than Sheamus and Bryan. And I'll tell you what, if they go to WrestleMania with this match, I'm calling it right now. I see them opening the show with it. Would not surprise me at all. A repeat of WrestleMania 28. Only this time I would hope the match goes a little bit longer than 18 seconds. Maybe double that. Let it go 30 or 40 seconds this time before you end it. So, I don't like this idea. I did do the column. I had some people point that out to me. I'm not backtracking. It's just that the circumstances are different. I mean, it makes sense. But I think to really make it work, Bryan needs to be the champion. That's the whole point. Sheamus sees that this guy has gone on to much bigger things. Meanwhile, he's been sitting on his ass at home, recuperating. Now he comes back. No wonder he turns heel. He's pissed off. He wants revenge. And in the process, he wants to take the belt from Bryan. Without the belt, this doesn't excite me at all. And going into the biggest show of the year, I just feel the guy should be a little bit higher up on the card. So if this is true, and this is the best that they can come up with for Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania 30, that's a big letdown. Raw this past Monday night was in Dayton, Ohio. I have a full review of Raw up on our YouTube channel. I posted a special episode of Sound Off Extra. I think it was back on Wednesday this week. So if you're not a subscriber on our YouTube channel, go now and subscribe, because every time one of these Sound Off Extras pops up, and they could be any day of the week, who knows, you'll be the first to know if you are a subscriber. So my username is the Solomonster, all one word. That's how you can find me. Full thoughts on Batista's return, a very bizarre ending to the show with John Cena and Randy Orton, a brawl that I think left a lot to be desired. Full 35-minute review. It's up on YouTube. I'm not going to get into it here, so go check it out on there. Raw did do a big, big number on Monday night. Its best audience in something like, I think, 10 months. 4.86 million viewers. They started out with over 5 million viewers. That's a lot of people. You know, back in the day, that was the norm. But you don't get 5 million people tuning into Raw every single week anymore. And it dwindled from there. I have no idea where the drop-off took place. I'm sure the Randy Orton, Kofi Kingston main event probably did not entice a lot of people to stick around. But they certainly started out big. And I see a lot of people online crediting the this wasn't really a cliffhanger. The whole thing at the end of Raw the week before, that great reaction Brian got breaking away from the Wyatt family. I don't think that had hardly anything to do with it at all. I'm a realist here, and the fact is they were promoting Batista's return for a month. They did a great job of promoting it and getting people to tune in and showing highlights from his career every single week on TV. Batista was a big star back in the day. I think that rating is at least 90% or more attributed to Batista. And there's nothing else that goes on Raw in a typical week, whether it's Punk, Cena, Bryan, or anybody else, that would cause 5.2 million people to tune in at the beginning of the show. As awesome as that closing scene was the week before, that has no effect on the ratings. I don't see how he got a great reaction, Brian did, and so all these, a million new people tuned in during hour one of Raw. I don't buy it. It was all Batista. He deserves all the credit for the number. I give it to him. Is he going to draw those numbers this week, the week after that? That I'm not so sure of. The Rock did pretty well when he would come back. You know, he would help lift Raw to some pretty big ratings when he was around. I don't know that Batista's on the same level as The Rock, but Batista's been gone for 4 years. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. We'll see. But for 1 week at least, big, big numbers. And, you know, we can complain all we want to about the creative stuff and whatever else. This is a great time if you are an executive up there in Titan Tower. You know, they just pulled 5 million viewers for Raw at a time when they're in a negotiating window with NBC Universal, trying to up their TV rights fees. They're trying to double, at least double, their TV rights fees. So the timing of this could not be any better. Their stock is soaring, as high as I've ever seen it. They still have a month to go until the launch of the new network. WrestleMania is coming up, which is when they do their big business every year. So if you work in WWE, if you're one of the executives there, you got to be pretty happy with the way things are going right now. And it's funny, I mentioned NBC Universal. There was a story in the New York Post this week that, you know, as they continue to negotiate, part of what NBC Universal is doing to sweeten the pot is offering to, I don't know if they're offering to build it themselves, but they're offering to house a physical WWE Hall of Fame building at Universal Studios. And there's been a lot of rumors about this before. That's all it's been, is rumor. There's never been any sort of confirmation about this. This is the closest thing that we have to confirmation that NBC Universal is at least interested in housing a WWE Hall of Fame. So I think it's safe to say that if they stick with NBC and they keep Raw on USA and they keep, you know, SmackDown on Sci-Fi and they don't go anywhere, may not be too much longer before we have an actual physical Hall of Fame building that we could visit, which would be pretty cool. And one final note on the WWE stuff here. I have to mention this. Jim Ross did an interview with the website Grantland.com. And among the highlights of his interview was this little nugget here. This is regarding the whole SummerSlam Ric Flair fiasco from last year. This is what JR said. He said, "I don't think you have to be a Mensa member to figure out that it had an influence on decisions that were made. I was working with the developmental kids and enjoying that, and got called in for that job," that being the 2K14 panel. "It was a very unique night, to say the least. Rick was coming off maybe the most traumatic time of his life, that being Reed's death. In hindsight, it might not have been the most timely booking to get him in that environment. And then you can also look at the other side and say maybe it was a good thing to get him out there amongst friends. As it turned out, you probably would lean more towards the former than the latter. But here's the deal. I was the conductor of a runaway train. I was supposed to keep it on the tracks, and that did not happen. So I don't have any issues taking responsibility. Now, did I envision that it would help facilitate my exit? No. But I could see the thinking behind it." So can we please stop finally calling this a retirement? This was not a retirement. The guy got shit canned. I think this is the first time that he's alluded to that publicly. He's been pretty quiet. He hasn't really said much. Maybe he's hinted at it here and there. This is the first interview he's done since last summer that he's pretty much all but come out without actually saying it and said, yeah, I was let go. I was fired over what happened. And it is what it is. I just see some people still referring to it as a retirement. Call it a forced retirement. How about that? It's just so stupid. It wasn't a retirement. Just call it what it is. The guy got fired. And he seems very happy now. He just signed a deal with Fox Sports to do articles on their website. He's got his one-man show. He's bringing his one-man show to New York here on March 1st. I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to that. He's got a podcast starting up soon, I think, on Wednesdays on Podcast One. He's keeping busy. JR seems very happy. He's moved on. But I had one person email me and say, well, you know, maybe it's possible that he actually kind of let the train go off the tracks because he kind of wanted to get fired. Maybe he just wasn't happy. No, he was very happy. He said that in the interview. He was very content to work with the NXT people and help out there and some of the other things that he was doing in WWE. He was not unhappy with that. He was perfectly content. So for the doubters and the skeptics that still remained out there, I'm happy that we can just finally clear this up and move on. NXT this past week, another good show. Tom Phillips, Byron Saxton, who is settling into this role now as the heel of the commentary crew, and Tenzai, they seem like the new permanent announce team going forward. Maybe not. Maybe I'm just reading too much into it. They've been together now, I think, for at least the last 2 or 3 weeks. And Renee Young, they trotted her out there later on to do commentary for one of the matches, but no William Regal in sight. Hopefully he'll be back at some point. One person who is back is Eden, the former Eden Styles. She was a ring announcer for WWE for a period of time, and you may know her better now as the current Mrs. Cody Rhodes, Cody Rhodes' new wife. And she's a beautiful girl. I certainly do not mind her being the new ring announcer on NXT. And not only she looks good, but she's actually not a bad ring announcer. She actually tries to, she has her own voice. She's not stiff and just, you know, very vanilla and plain. She tries to put a little oomph behind it, which is kind of cool. So very good to see her back. Adrian Neville beat Wesley Blake in the opening match. The only thing I know about Wesley Blake, he came out wearing a cowboy hat. That's about the only thing I know about this guy. Neville beat him with the Red Arrow. And, you know, between this and his win over Tyler Breeze last week on NXT, it's pretty obvious they're building Neville for something bigger. You know, that we all know that now, but it's just obvious the way they've been building him and giving him more TV time each week. I mean, think about it. He was in a feud for a while with Corey Graves. And I think Graves may have suffered a concussion. I think he's over it now. I think, as a matter of fact, I think he's going to be back next week. But you look at the two side by side, look what's happened since their feud has ended. Graves, I don't even think, has been on television one time since then. And Neville has moved on. He's ascended higher up the card. They give him some squash matches. They put him in the ring with a guy like Breeze, give him a big win. I like the way they're building him. We had a backstage interview with the BFFs, and Charlotte is back. If you remember, the daughter of the Nature Boy, the Nature Girl, I guess we can call her, had turned on Bayley. This was months ago, and aligned herself with Summer Rae and Sasha Banks, and then she vanished. And I guess she may have had some sort of injury. She needed, I think, minor surgery, I remember reading. So she's been gone for a while, and this was the first appearance for Charlotte back in quite some time. They let her cut a promo. I was not a fan of her promo work here. She's got some work to do. She's still very new to the whole thing. I think given her pedigree, probably, and her background, I think in due time she'll be fine. Alexander Rusev beat Xavier Woods, who now comes out to Brodus Clay's old theme full-time. It's not just a temporary thing. That is his new music, apparently. Which is too bad because, you know, at least with his old gimmick and his old music, it was his. Now it just feels like he's inheriting somebody else's gimmick, which he is. It's exactly what he's doing. Normally they wait until the old act is out of the company before recycling gimmicks. Rusev has ditched the Tarzan gear. He now wears black spandex. I'm not one to go on and on about what the guys are wearing. That's just very weird to me to care too much about how one guy is dressed. But I did make the comment that whatever the hell it was he was wearing before, he looked like Jungle Jim, and it just wasn't a look that really worked for him. Now at least he looks like something out of a Street Fighter video game, so it's a much improved look for him. He made short work of Xavier Woods with his accolade finish. He would not release the hold until Lana told him to do so. And then she told him to put it right back on. And he obliged. And all I can say to this, you know, tits and ass is a universal language, my friends. Doesn't matter if you're American or Bulgarian. If a hot woman tells you to do something, your other head tells you to do it. That's just how it is. Tenzai was appalled by all of this, even though he makes no attempt to save Xavier Woods through this entire thing. See, I think, you want to know what I think? I think he's just more concerned that Xavier Woods keeps going out there and losing, and he's besmirching his old theme music. I think that's probably what he cares about more than anything else. So, who comes out then to save Xavier Woods? If you said Sin Cara, I bet you would be the only one. But indeed it was Sin Cara, of all people. I guess he could take no more. He pulls off a really poor-looking Hurricanrana that Rusev has to sell, which just looked terrible. I'm not sure I like all of these guys from the main roster taking up time on these shows lately. You know, one or two here and there is fine. I have no problem with that. I think it could even make the show feel a little more special. And Antonio Cesaro is beloved in the NXT arena and barely gets any television time on the main roster anyway, so I really have no problem with him popping up on NXT. But Cesaro aside, you've got Woods, now you've got Sin Cara, you've got Natalya every other week now is seemingly on this show, you've got Kofi Kingston, and you've got somebody else who I'm going to get to in a moment. So I think they need to dial it back a little bit. Less main roster guys and more NXT guys. Speaking of Cesaro, he was out next for a match with the most hated man on the NXT roster. And this isn't just me talking, okay? I'm not just hating on CJ Parker for the hell of it. I'm not the only man who just has absolutely no use for this guy whatsoever. Everybody in the NXT arena hates this man. Everybody. Talking about CJ Parker, the Moonchild or Man Bear Pig, whatever the fuck he calls himself. Finish was actually quite great. CJ Parker got Cesaro up for an airplane spin, sets him down, and Cesaro just stands there, cranks his neck, and gives Parker the Cesaro swing, and then finishes him off with the neutralizer. The fans loved it. Loud chants of, "We the people." This man is criminally underutilized. And you know what makes me really sad? I noticed on Twitter, Billy Gunn posted two pictures of him training like his legs at the Performance Center, because he spends a lot of time down there because Billy Gunn is a trainer down there. I mean, I know he's back on TV now, but he's an NXT trainer. So he's got these pictures of him training at the Performance Center in preparation for his big tag team title match at the Rumble against Cody and Goldust. The guy he had helping him train in the photos, the guy who was training him, his partner, Antonio Cesaro. Just the image of Antonio Cesaro helping Billy Gunn to train for his match at the Royal Rumble when Cesaro himself has no match just makes me very sad. So after the match, Sami Zayn walks out on crutches. He says 2014 is not off to a great start for him. 2013, though, was the best year of his career. And some of his best matches were with Antonio Cesaro, and he wants a chance to erase that one blemish on his year, which was the 2 out of 3 falls lost to Cesaro. And so Antonio walks up the ramp, goes right up to Sami Zayn, yanks the microphone out of his hands, and just says, "No," and drops it and walks away. So they're going to do a slow build to the rematch between the two, which, as most of you know by now anyway, spoiler, but not much of one. The rematch is going to take place between Cesaro and Zayn on the live NXT Network special February 27th. I cannot wait for that. And then we had a backstage segment. This fucking segment. Devin Taylor is in the back with The Miz. Yes, The Miz is on NXT. And he talks about how great NXT is and all of this stuff. And he threatened to do a Miz TV when all of a sudden CJ Parker comes into camera view, and he's pacing back and forth, and he's complaining that all these crowds, they just boo me. All these people want to do is boo me. I don't understand why. Because you suck, that's why. But he can't figure it out. And The Miz is offended by this interruption, and so CJ Parker decides to cut a very annoying promo on him, using all of these different hippie words and terminology and all this crap. And this is all punctuated by the girliest slap I've ever seen. CJ Parker slaps The Miz. And The Miz just kind of looks at him, Because, you know, if you were in a real fight or if somebody walked up to you in real life and slapped the shit out of you, what would your reaction be? Of course, naturally, your reaction would be to look in the guy's eyes and let him run away. That's what a normal person would do. That's what The Miz did here. The Miz did not fight back. The Miz did not beat down this little NXT jabroni. He looked at him, he scared him, and CJ Parker ran away. So I assume this is building to a match, and boy, I can't wait for that match. The Miz against CJ Parker. There are no winners, only losers. And the losers are the fans. I could not believe it when I saw these guys in the same segment together. These two guys, of all people. And I love NXT, but holy shit. I do not need to see these two guys together. I don't need to see these two guys on this show separately. Keep The Miz on Raw and SmackDown. Okay, I don't need to see him on NXT, and I sure as shit don't need to see CJ Parker. The only saving grace of this is that they're acknowledging now that the people are booing him, so maybe they're going to turn him heel. Maybe at some point he'll drop the whole hippie shtick, and he'll just be a normal person. I know being a normal person doesn't exactly set you apart. You have to come up with a character. You have to come up with a gimmick that sets you apart from everybody else. But this gimmick, it ain't working. It's just not working. And it's actually quite annoying. Maybe it'll be more appropriate as a heel. Maybe he'll learn to make this work as a bad guy. Instead of coming out and looking like a fool and expecting people to get behind him. I cannot see how anybody in their right mind, whether you are the son or daughter of a flower child or not, could possibly root for somebody like CJ Parker. I don't see it. You have to explain to me what makes you want to cheer for a guy like CJ Parker. We got a pre-recorded backstage promo with Natalia, another main roster person on the show, who says her New Year's resolution is to get hungry and forget her manners. Playing off the same line used by her dad once upon a time in a promo. The only difference is when Jim the Anvil Neidhart said it, it was so completely ridiculous that it was actually funny. I would bet anything that less than 1% of the audience watching this even knows that, even knows where that line is from. So when Natalia said it, she just sounded completely ridiculous. Natalia was out there next with Bayley in her corner. She beat Summer Rae with the sharpshooter in a pretty good match. I enjoy watching Summer Rae, the progression of Summer Rae as a wrestler, you know. And she took the sharpshooter better than any male wrestler I've seen in years. Because she let, you know, Natalia went pretty far back on it and made the move actually look brutal for a change. I guess I'm so used to seeing people put that move on who either don't know how to do it, like The Rock back in the day. Who couldn't do a sharpshooter to save his life, or Sting now, who can't even bend his knees. It's kind of nice when I see Natalia kind of bend back on it like that. Looks far more devastating when she does it than when Sting uses it, I can tell you that. I think if he comes to WWE, hopefully he sticks to the death drop. Backstage, Devin Taylor is with Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy. A lot of backstage promos on the show. So they're playing catch-up here because it was either last week or the week before we had, like, no backstage promos at all. It was all in-ring action. And so it looks like they really stocked up on the promos here on the show. But she's backstage with Enzo and Colin Cassidy. You know, they're back there doing their thing. You know, how you doing? All that kind of stuff. Aiden English interrupted and was talking smack. Colin Cassidy said that Aiden English has taken so many cheap shots, he's surprised he hasn't left with an ugly girl. It was a clever line. I like that. I don't know that everybody watching necessarily got that line. I did, though. I like that. And so English starts to sing. Enzo, who is still in his scooter, by the way, recovering from his broken leg, he scoots right over Aiden English's foot. And that was the whole segment. Then it was time for the banner-raising ceremony in celebration of Bo Dallas becoming the longest reigning NXT champion of all time at 224 days. He thanks his family, he thanks his friends for coming, he points to random people in the crowd, including his third cousin, his sister's college roommate, his fourth grade history teacher. And it's funny because the camera, when he said that, cut to an older lady in the crowd, and I would laugh so hard if that actually was his fourth grade history teacher. Adrian Neville comes out to confront the champion. I still cannot buy Adrian Neville on the microphone. I'm sorry. He's a very talented guy. He's fun to watch. But I had some of you guys email me 2 weeks ago. I made a comment about how Neville sounds like he's got marbles in his mouth when he speaks. I got emails explaining that's how the Jordy accent sounds. And, yeah, I felt bad. I mean, believe me, I wasn't trying to be disrespectful or anything. That's just how it sounds to me. I know Neville wears a mouthpiece during his matches, so I legitimately thought maybe he speaks with it in his mouth. You know, maybe he's got a retainer or something that causes that. But apparently that's how all Jordys sound. I had one person tell me all of them get burdened with that horrible accent, is what that person told me. So I guess he just can't help it. I don't see that doing him any favors when he hits the main roster. I could be wrong. Dallas reminds us that Neville earned his last title shot by winning a Beat the Clock challenge in 4 minutes and 45 seconds. And he says, wouldn't take me 4 minutes and 45 seconds to beat you. Cue Triple H, who appears on the TitanTron, sets up a match between the two where if Bo Dallas cannot beat Adrian Neville in 4 minutes and 45 seconds, he will get himself another title shot on the live NXT special, February 27th. And that match starts right now. So poor Bo in his street clothes had to wrestle Neville, who did in fact survive the 4 minutes and 45 seconds and will get his title match. And afterwards, Neville hit the red arrow on Bo Dallas, stands over him holding the NXT title up in the air. And that's how we went off the air. So a good episode. Not great. You know, they've come down a little bit from that string of two or three fantastic shows they did several weeks ago. But they've started building to that February 27th show, which is supposed to be like their version of an NXT pay-per-view, almost. And again, it's probably going to go head-to-head with Impact that night, which, if that's the case, TNA is going to have to wait that week, because I am looking forward to this NXT show more than anything else. I'm probably looking more forward to this show than I am the Elimination Chamber. I don't even know any of the matches on that show yet. But they've done a good job of starting the build, and I already know the matches. You know, I read the spoilers about what the matches would be, and I don't even need to know anything else that's going to happen on the show that night. If those are the two big matches they build up, Cesaro and Zayn, and the Bo Dallas-Adrian Neville match, which is going to have a special stipulation. I won't spoil that in case some people still don't know. We'll find out what that is in the coming weeks. That just makes it even better, I think. And I'm looking forward to it. I really am. Check this out, guys. For you, the listeners of The Sound Off, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial so that you can check out their service. And it's a quality service. I wouldn't be mentioning it on my show if it wasn't. They have a bunch of wrestling books to choose from in audio form, including Lex Luger's book, Dusty Rhodes' book, Hulk Hogan's book is available with narration from the Hulkster himself. There's even one that chronicles the rise of the late Junkyard Dog in Mid-South, which sounds really interesting. You can choose any one of those free by trying audible.com. If you commute to work, or if you like listening to things other than music at the gym, I know a lot of people listen to this podcast that way. It seems to me an audiobook would absolutely make sense. To get one, make sure you go to audibletrial.com/solomonster. It's another way to show your support for The Sound Off, and you get something free in return. Can't beat that. Again, that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. We start out the Impact Report with some good news for TNA this week for a change. Actually, two very good news items. Number one, this week's Genesis edition of Impact was way up from the week before. Did over 1.5 million viewers. Its best number in a year since last January. So doing a pay-per-view live and free on Spike TV finally pays off for them. I don't have the quarter-hour breakdowns. I'm very curious to see which segments did the best. I would think Sting's possible final match in TNA would have been a draw, but I don't know. It's too bad, you know, good ratings don't correlate to good quality programming, because this week's show is only slightly better than the garbage they gave us last week. We'll get to Impact in a second. The other good news for TNA is that they are no longer homeless, and their new home is the same house they were living in before. They have worked out a deal to return to Universal Studios in Orlando by moving their taping schedule around a little bit. So now they're going to be taping their shows at the end of the week and the weekend, as opposed to in the middle of the week, which is what they have traditionally done. So they've got dates booked through the beginning of May, including an unnamed pay-per-view on April 27th. I've read that it might be Destination X, but nobody knows for sure what that event is going to be. But at least they have some place to tape now, and they won't have to go back out on the road, which was probably going to bankrupt them if they had to. The whole point of getting off the road was because they couldn't afford it. So that could have been a big disaster for the company. So disaster averted, at least until May. So that's good news for TNA. Which brings us to Impact. Genesis, Part 2. Yet another show with way too much Dixie Carter and a shit main event. And in between all of that, we had a really good cage match between Kurt Angle and Bobby Roode. We had a decent, I guess, match between Austin Aries and Chris Sabin. I was not impressed. There was nothing else about this Genesis show that made it feel special in any way. It opened with, who else? Dixie Carter, Rockstar Spud, who, I have to say this, Rockstar Spud is actually quite great in his role, I have to admit. He's great in small doses. Not when he's all over the damn show, but I like Spud. And with them was Dixie Carter's attorney. He has to be doing pro bono work for them, because there's no way TNA can afford a high-powered attorney. Magnus was also with them. I almost forgot the world champion. The lawyer informs them that someone is planning a hostile takeover of TNA and has been buying up shares for months now. Stop. Okay, let's stop here for a second. Question. Last I checked, TNA was not a publicly traded company. So how then, unless this mystery person is already employed by TNA, and maybe then there's a way that they can be buying up shares, I don't even know. How can someone on the outside be buying up shares of the company right underneath the nose of the owner? How does that even work? That is a legitimate question. I'm listening to this guy talk about shares and all this kind of stuff, and I mean, I know WWE is a publicly traded company, and you can buy and sell shares. Like, if I want to turn around and buy a piece of WWE tomorrow, I can do that. With TNA, much like UFC and a lot of these other companies, they're not publicly traded companies. There are no shares that you and I can go out and buy. And how does any of this crap happen without Dixie Carter knowing about it if she's the frickin' owner? It's so stupid. This new investor is already making decisions. He ruled that Sting will have somebody in his corner tonight for the match against Magnus. Magnus said, fine, then I want the match to be no DQ. And the attorney said that he can make that happen. This man seems awfully sure of himself, you know? I mean, what, does he have a bat phone that connects directly to this new investor? He's so sure that he can make it happen? So none of this made any sense. This guy who played the attorney was terrible. And what a way to start out their Genesis edition of Impact here. Magnus, Spud, EC3 all came to the ring. Sting came out. He denied knowing who the investor was. You know, he's got one foot out the door. You think he gives a shit who the investor is? Sting got the crowd, the champ, paper champion at Magnus, who slapped Sting across the face. So he got jumped at that point by the rest of the Dixieland bunch. Until Samoa Joe ran down to make the save. Joe will be in Sting's corner for the main event. Backstage, more Dixie. She wanted Spud to make sure that Joe does not make it to the main event, and her brilliant idea was to put Spud himself in a match with Samoa Joe. A man who has had bigger meals and bigger bowel movements than Rockstar Spud. You know, I thought people were joking when they said this, but the more I watch this show, I'm starting to really believe that Dixie is supposed to be, in storyline, is supposed to be the dumbest owner in the history of wrestling. That's the storyline. And what a storyline it is. We had Gunner against James Storm in their briefcase on a pole match. So Gunner won. He maintains his TNA World title shot. The crowd sucked for this. And I have to say, they sucked for almost the entire show. Reason being, it was the second taping. And these crowds are notoriously dead for these second tapings. So I felt kind of bad for these guys. Mike Tenay made it clear very early in the bout that the winner had to maintain possession of the briefcase after retrieving it, so they pretty much telegraphed the finish right there. Apparently the briefcase is now a football, which makes sense, I guess, given that NFL referees have been about as reliable with their calls lately as pro wrestling referees. Sure enough, just as Storm retrieved the briefcase, he got knocked off the top rope and it went flying. Both guys are down now. They suddenly realize where the briefcase is. They scramble for it. Gunner beats up James Storm and just picks it up. So the fans didn't really seem to know what the hell was going on, since they never announced the whole possession thing to the audience. I'm guessing Storm is going heel. You know, may as well at this point. What the hell else is there for the guy to do? We saw a YouTube video of Velvet Sky in her bedroom earlier in the week, and never in my life did I ever think a video of Velvet Sky in her bedroom could be so boring. She opened a gift from Sabin Inside was a teddy bear and a lead pipe. He's quite the romantic that Chris Sabin is. This led to Austin Aries against Sabin for the X Division title with Velvet Sky outside the ring in a cage. She had the gift in there with her. Sabin went to retrieve the gift from her during the match at one point and was very pissed off to find out that all he had in his hands was a teddy bear. There was no lead pipe. And Aries came off the top with a double axe handle. He nailed a missile drop kick, finished off Sabin with the brain buster to regain his X Division championship. Velvet didn't seem to care that her boyfriend just lost. And then they immediately cut away, rendering this title change completely meaningless. You know, there's a reason I watch Austin Aries, a guy like him, you know, because the dude is really, really good. He has great matches. This wasn't a great match. It was just the backdrop to a stupid angle. So I don't really have much good stuff to say about it. I mean, these guys, I'm sure, could go out there if you give them 10, 15 minutes and have a great match. When they give you 4 or 5 minutes and there's a fucking teddy bear involved, there's not really a lot to say. We got a vignette with the Wolves, Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards, bashing Dixie for treating them like prelim guys the week before. They said the new investor will be revealed to the world next week in Glasgow. So they're not wasting any time, which I like. You know, the quicker I think they do the reveal of who the person is, the better. I noticed Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer thinks it's MVP. He says MVP is debuting shortly for TNA regardless, so it would make sense that it would be him. You know, what I find most troubling is that this storyline of the whole investor against Dixie, from what I've read, is supposed to carry on through October, assuming TNA lives that long. And I believe they'll do it, too. You know, this is the same company that kept Aces and Eights alive for 18 months. So if you haven't gotten your fill of Dixie yet, if your Dixie cup isn't full, this is only the beginning. You know, just to go back to the Wolves for a second, I was thinking about how awful their debut was last week and what the original plan supposedly was, which was they were going to come in as a surprise instead of having Dixie leak it herself on Twitter. And then they were going to beat the Bromans on their first night in and win the tag team titles. Would that not have been a better idea to get them over the first night as something special by having them just come in and win the belts? You know, maybe this new investor will give them a tag title match on an upcoming episode of Impact, and their baby faces, let's say, you know, they can feud with, you know, Daniels and Kazarian for the belts. It's not like they have any other teams anyway. I mean, I assume at some point that that's going to be the next big tag team feud. Kurt Angle beat Bobby Roode in their steel cage match to keep his TNA Hall of Fame dreams alive. As a match, it was the best thing on the entire show. When I first read that they were going to do a cage match on the show, which was weeks ago, you know, I said it right here on the Sound Off, that Kurt Angle was not going to be able to get through that match without doing a fucking moonsault. And he did not disappoint. Kurt Angle, a man who probably, in all honesty, wouldn't even be able to pass a physical in WWE, which may be where he's headed later this year as a trainer for NXT, if reports are to be believed. Okay, a man who, as AJ Styles said in his shoot interview, which I'm in the middle of right now, the shoot that he did with High Spots, walks around the locker room sometimes like he's in agony. Okay, this man climbed to the top of the cage and did a moonsault off the top, completely missed Bobby Roode. Bobby Roode rolled out of the way and crashed and burned. He landed right on his hip, right on his knee, and bounced. He bounced off the canvas. And of course, all the sheep at the Impact Zone in wherever the hell they taped this, in Huntsville, okay, I call it the Impact Zone, but all the people in attendance did their obligatory "This is awesome" chant, and it pissed me off because all that does is encourage this guy to keep doing crazy shit like this. He's out of his mind. Absolutely out of his mind. And TNA encourages it. You really think that TNA went to Kurt Angle and said to him, "Hey, don't do any moonsaults tonight"? I mean, maybe they did. I wasn't there, so maybe they did. If they did, that makes it even worse, because what must Kurt Angle think of TNA management to just blow him off and do it anyway? So I'm guessing they did not do that. And by booking him in a cage match, they had to know. They knew this guy was going to do this. And they did nothing to stop it. I mean, it's to the point now where when I see him do shit like that, I feel guilty. I feel guilty when I watch him. Kurt Angle should not be doing moonsaults off the top of a cage. Cody Rhodes did a moonsault off the cage at Madison Square Garden last month at a frickin' house show. The difference is that he was caught by somebody else. Okay, Antonio Cesaro caught him on the way down. It was about as safe as you could possibly do a moonsault off the top of a cage. And Cody is only 28 years old. Kurt Angle is 45 with the body of a 65-year-old. It bothers me when I see him do stuff like this. You know, Kurt likes to say, you know, TNA saved my life in a way. You know, when he left WWE, he was in really bad shape. And he went to TNA. TNA gave him a home, fewer dates, less travel, less stress. I think now, all these years later, we've come full circle. Going back to WWE, whether it's a trainer, an agent, sign a Legends deal, whatever, you know, that might do more to save this guy's life than staying in TNA would. But the guy is crazy. He can't help himself. So they did a finish similar to Hulk Hogan and Paul Orndorff back in 86. They did the whole split screen and everything, showing both guys trying to reach the floor first. Rude went out the door. Angle finally climbed down. So he hit the ground first. Looked like he may have hurt his knee on the way down. So Kurt Angle finally exercises the demons. He gets a win over Bobby Roode. They played up the Hall of Fame thing. They better hope Kurt re-signs with the company in August when his contract is up. Because if he doesn't, or even worse, if he does go back to WWE, that's going to be really embarrassing for them. If they're doing this Hall of Fame storyline for most of the year, and he leaves before they can induct him. Because remember, they had the chance. They were going to induct him last year, and they did that stupid angle where he rejected his induction. You know, I mean, talk about giving people a reason to make fun of TNA. You turn the Hall of Fame into a storyline. You turn it into a joke. I mean, it was a joke anyway. But you have the guy reject going in. He says, you know what? I don't even want to go into your Hall of Fame. So they did it to themselves. And now, if this guy leaves before they can actually do the induction, and if Sting goes to WWE, that's another TNA Hall of Famer out the door. I guess it is a good thing that they never inducted Jeff Jarrett. Everyone thought Jeff Jarrett was going to be the first inductee instead of Sting. It's a good thing it wasn't, because now he's gone too. They should just induct Mike Tenay, because that fucking guy's never leaving that company. He'd be a safe pick, so would Borash. EC3 gave Rockstar Spud a pep talk backstage before his match with Joe, his walking to his execution, you might say. Was this the segment where they brought up that Spud won their British boot camp reality show, and Spud's response was, yeah, but I beat two women. It was either here or it was the segment with Dixie earlier in the show. I just thought that was the funniest thing the whole night. That actually made me laugh out loud. So EC3 got Spud all fired up, gave him a kiss on the forehead, and then walked away, pretty much knowing that Spud was going to get killed. And in the ring, we had the bromans with DJ Zema Ion. Zema cut possibly the most annoying promo of all time. So annoying that even Taz on commentary had no choice but to acknowledge how annoying it was. But they're heels, I guess, so that's their job. Eric Young came out, a brawl ensued. He was getting beaten down. Out came Abyss to make the save. He beat up the tag team champions, spared Eric Young. Next week, it's EY and Joe Park against Robbie and Jesse. Samoa Joe destroyed Rockstar Spud in about 2 minutes with the Muscle Buster and the Coquina Clutch for the tap out. It's pretty much all there was to it. And then we had the main event. Magnus against Sting in quite possibly Sting's final TNA match, his TNA swan song, with the world title on the line up against Sting's contract. If this was it for Sting and TNA, and you never know, you know, who's to say that he won't be brought back next week overseas by the new investor. But if this is it, what a pathetic way to send the guy out. And what a pathetic way for Magnus to retain his title yet again with a million run-ins. Sting got the Scorpion Deathlock on Magnus, and that brought out Daniels and Kazarian, who jumped on Samoa Joe outside. EC3 ran in to attack Sting. I feel like I saw this 3 weeks ago. I feel like deja vu. And they edited the shit out of this thing, you could tell, which is not surprising. I read in the spoilers from some of the people who were there and others that there were a whole bunch of blown spots during the match, and Sting had this look on his face like he was visibly pissed off about the whole thing, so it looked like they edited most of that out. Bromans and DJ Zema ran out. Kurt Angle ran down to make the save and delivered some suplexes. So it was back down to Sting and Magnus. Sting gave him a superplex from the top rope, which was actually very impressive to see Sting pull that off. I was not expecting that. You know, he was certainly trying. He was trying to make chicken salad out of chicken shit. I don't think he succeeded, but, you know, damn it, he tried. Bobby Roode interfered and attacked Sting. Magnus gave Sting the snowplow, or the Michinoku driver, whatever you prefer to call it. And this was terrible because Magnus had Sting's leg hooked, right? He gives him the move. He's got Sting's leg hooked in the middle of the ring, and it took forever for Dixie to drag Earl Hebner down to the ring to count the fall. You know, it looked completely ridiculous that Sting would stay down for that long. And then what's even worse, the camera missed the whole thing. The camera missed the three count. They blew the finish of the match. So Dixie hands Sting's contract to Magnus. He tears it up, and that's how the show goes off the air. 3 straight weeks of crappy finishes. They better have something good planned with this investor storyline this Thursday, because right now, it's not Impact Wrestling. It's the Dixie Carter Show featuring Impact Wrestling. That's what it is. And I see these reports online claiming that Vince Russo is either back working with TNA Creative, or he's doing some consulting on the creative there. His name, I guess, was CC'd on some emails that were going around between creative team members. Judging by the last couple of weeks of TV, wouldn't surprise me in the least. But if Russo turns out to be the mystery investor and starts popping up on my TV, I'm done. I don't think it's going to happen, but if it did, if that little weasel worms his way back onto my TV screen, I'm finished with TNA. I have stuck with them for almost 2 years now. You know, again, before that, I would watch here and there. Didn't really pay too much attention to it because it was so horrible. It'll be 2 years this May, actually, since I missed a full episode of Impact. I've stuck with it. I have stuck with it longer than I thought I would, largely because I decided to give it a chance because Russo left. And I heard good things that, you know, I think Bruce Pritchard at the time had taken over and things were turning around and the shows were more enjoyable. They were easier to follow, less bullshit and all that kind of stuff. So I started watching and I've been with it ever since. There is no way I am watching a show with him on it. I don't think he's going to be a TV character, and TNA won't confirm that he's back with them. They deny the whole thing. But you watch these shows, and the signs are all there. You know, his fingerprints are all over these last 3 weeks or 4 weeks of shows. So in due time, we'll find out. As far as Sting goes, there's nothing left for him in TNA. If he's going to make a clean break, now's the time for him to do it. Go to the mailbag. If you have questions, email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You could also send audio questions as attachments in MP3 format. And anybody who sends an email, please remember to include your name and where you're from. Ernie from Raleigh, North Carolina. I have a question about the placement of the tag team title match at the Royal Rumble. Why would a match featuring two of the most popular tag teams, like the New Age Outlaws and the Rhodes Family, be placed on the pre-show and not on the actual event itself? I don't feel like the card is very stacked. A match featuring two hot tag teams for the straps would be, or rather would add, a lot to the actual pay-per-view and the buy rate. I feel like WWE is missing an opportunity to make more money, and it cheapens the tag team belts. How do you feel about the booking of this match, and where would you place it on the Royal Rumble card? I don't think that that match is going to make a difference to the buy rate one way or the other. It's not going to matter. It's an undercard match. This pay-per-view is going to be bought and sold on the Royal Rumble. That's it. People aren't going to buy it for Bryan and Bray. I don't even think they're going to buy it for Cena and Orton. We've already seen it a million times. We already saw the TLC match. Now they're going to pay for a straight wrestling match between the two of them? I don't think so. It's all about the Rumble. So on this show, it doesn't matter. Pre-show, pay-per-view, it makes no difference to me, because I don't think it affects things one way or the other. James from Scotland. I was wondering if you think there will be anyone from the NXT roster who will enter this year's Royal Rumble, and if so, who? I don't think so. The only time they ever did that was two years ago. Actually, no, maybe it was last January. They had Bo Dallas, but if I remember, I think Bo Dallas won a match of some kind on NXT to earn a spot in the Rumble, so it was already kind of made in advance. It wasn't like he just went out there as a surprise and nobody knew who he was. I mean, nobody knew who he was anyway, because hardly anybody really either had access to or was paying attention to NXT. They've said nothing about it. They've done no tournament. They've done no special match to set that up. So I don't think anybody from NXT is going to be in the Rumble. And who would it be? Who from NXT would be in the Rumble? And don't say Cesaro, because that doesn't count. You know, they're going to put Adrian Neville in there? No. Sami Zayn? No. He's hurt anyway, so it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't even know who they would put in there. Adam from Michigan, who happens to share a birthday this Royal Rumble Sunday with WWE Hall of Famer Bob Uecker, Mr. Baseball. Have you heard the story of Jesse Ventura trying to unionize wrestling back in 1986 and Hulk Hogan blowing the whistle on him to Vince? Ventura mentioned it in an interview in 2008, but did not go too far in depth. Just wondered if you had any knowledge of this. Yeah, I mean, I've heard the same story that you have. I don't know that there are, you know, too many specific details. I mean, the basic gist of it is that Ventura got a bunch of wrestlers together. This was right before WrestleMania 2. And he said, this is it. This is the time for us to get together and to organize and to go to Vince and tell him that we're going to unionize. And Hogan got wind of it. Actually, I think it was Hogan and Bundy, if I remember correctly. And they were the two that were in the WrestleMania 2 main event. So I think Hogan and Bundy got wind of it and together went to Vince, blew the whistle, and obviously Vince was pissed. He couldn't have been too pissed because you would think he would fire the guy, but he didn't. Jesse stuck around and everything seemed to be cool, you know. Even Vince and Jesse would do commentary for many years on Saturday night's main event and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I guess it makes sense that they wouldn't have fired Ventura because that would have been really bad. I'm sure Vince didn't want any of this to get out, not in the media or anything like that. So a guy like Jesse, if you fire him, he ain't going to keep his mouth shut. So he probably would have been more of a nuisance than anything else. So I guess when you think about it like that, it's not really surprising he didn't get fired. But Vince was not happy. And Jesse had no idea that Hogan had ratted him out. It wasn't until many years later there was a lawsuit between Jesse and Vince McMahon. And I guess this all came up. And Vince was deposed, and in the deposition, he admitted that it was Hogan who tipped him off. So once Ventura found out about that, that was where the falling out happened between him and Hulk, because Jesse and Hulk had been pretty good friends up until that point. But it was several years later when Jesse found out that SOB was the one who ratted me out, and that's when their friendship went sour. Mike writes in, as I watch WWE, they keep saying that Randy Orton is the first unified champion. But why is no one mentioning Chris Jericho becoming the first undisputed champion? Because I guess it's not as impressive if they acknowledge that this has happened once before. See, their way of getting around it is that when Chris Jericho unified the belts, it was the WWF belt and the WCW belt. This is not the WCW belt. Of course, it's all semantics. It's all bullshit. Of course, Jericho did it way before Orton did. But it's less impressive, and this would not be the first time that WWE has ignored their own history. All those matches Undertaker and Triple H had in recent years at WrestleMania, not one time did they acknowledge the fact that they had already wrestled once before at WrestleMania. When Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker feuded in 2009, and they had those back-to-back matches in Mania, not one time did they acknowledge the feud, which was an awesome feud, that they had back in 1997. And I remember on the Sound Off, okay, this was years ago, and I was very much looking forward to Michaels and Undertaker. I couldn't believe it took them that long, because Shawn came back in 2002. It took them a long-ass time to put these two guys back together. And I'm glad they did, because they had the best match in WrestleMania history, or one of the best matches. And I remember at the time commenting on the Sound Off, how could they not acknowledge that past feud? It just makes sense because the last match they had was the casket match at the Royal Rumble. That was the match where Undertaker backdropped Michaels out of the ring and he hit his back and injured a whole bunch of discs, and that led to the back surgery, which led to 4 months out of wrestling. And he thought his career was over at that point. He took 4.5 years of the guy's career away from him. And I just felt like that was a natural, you didn't have to dwell on it, but you could certainly bring it up and say, listen, you know, you and I have a history together. And as a matter of fact, I haven't forgotten what you did to me. And just bring up what happened at the Rumble and the back injury, and they never did. And it kind of surprised me. So that's their MO. You know, they gloss over things and they just pretend like it never happened. Cliff says, Daniel Bryan not being in the Royal Rumble while Batista wins the Rumble is tantamount to Steve Austin being left out of the 1998 Royal Rumble while Lex Luger returns to win it and headline WrestleMania 15. Well, that's just crazy. See, now that's just crazy talk now. Batista, first of all, comparing Batista to Lex Luger, I will give Batista credit. Batista is a better wrestler than Lex Luger. And I would even argue that Batista became a bigger star than Lex Luger. He probably made more money than Lex Luger did. I mean, hey, maybe I'm wrong. Lex Luger did spend a lot more time in the wrestling business, but I don't remember Lex Luger ever headlining a pay-per-view like Batista did at WrestleMania that one year and making as much money as Batista probably did. I don't remember a time when Lex Luger was really like a box office draw. He was a flop in WWE. They tried. They put him on a fucking bus. They sent him all around the country. Didn't work. So I think comparing those two would be, if anything, an insult probably to Batista. And we've been through this before, the comparisons of Brian to Austin. It's just, it's comical. It's not the same thing. I see what you're trying to say, but it's not. It's not the same thing. Cole from Philadelphia. I was watching an old Cena match a while back, and during his match, he executed an awkward-looking dropkick. At least the guy tried. My question to you is, which wrestlers have the best dropkicks in wrestling history? Mr. Perfect. Mr. Perfect is always the first person that comes to mind when I think of, like, the best wrestling dropkicks. His was just, it was a thing of beauty. Randy Orton has a great dropkick. AJ Styles is another one. Dolph Ziggler. And Cole in his email mentions this guy, and I have to agree, Hardcore Holly had a freaking awesome dropkick. I don't think he gets enough credit for that. He's got to be in that conversation too, but Mr. Perfect would be number one on my list. Ben from Fresno, California. Say a crowd in a certain town decides to be dead for an entire show. If you're Vince McMahon, would you punish them by not having a show in that town the next year, or just have a house show and not a television show? Or would you not even punish them at all? I know what WWE presents for storyline should be to blame for some of the bad crowd reactions, but sometimes the crowd just sucks, with my examples being the bad crowd reactions for Batista and Jake the Snake Roberts. Look, I think the crowd reaction to Batista was fine. In another city, I'm sure it would have been even louder, but it's not like they were sitting on their hands. You know, they were cheering, they were chanting the guy's name. I mean, what do you expect them to do? For Jake? Yeah, it was really shitty to see him come out, and it seemed like half the crowd didn't even know who he was. They didn't recognize him. You know, maybe it was the shorter hair. That was the first time I think Jake's been on TV with the short hair. Everybody remembers him with the longer hair. But, you know, Jake also hasn't really been relevant in wrestling probably in 20 years or more. And you got a lot of younger fans, a lot of newer fans. So, you know, I you can only really blame them so much. As far as punishing them, as a businessman, I would say that is a horrible idea. To say, well, you know, this one week the crowd really didn't react, so fuck them, we're not going to come back. I think if it's a pattern, if you go back to the same city over and over again, and the crowd is just always dead, it's always shit. I'll use New York as an example. Madison Square Garden is great. Nassau Coliseum out on Long Island sucks. They are notorious for having some of the worst crowds. So if they don't want to come to the Nassau Coliseum as often, see, that I understand. Or just bring, you know, house shows if you're worried about what the crowd reaction is going to be on TV. You can do that. That's fine. I don't know what the attendance was at Raw in Ohio. The Ohio crowds generally suck, based on what I remember. You know, even Brett, when Brett came back, they didn't really react that great to him. It was okay. But, I mean, if they sold out the building, why the hell wouldn't you go back there? If you're selling tickets and you're packing the whole building, it's foolish not to go back there. So there's a lot of different things you got to keep in mind. And lastly here, Derek Jones wants to know, is there a time you can recall from your earlier years as a wrestling fan where Mean Gene Okerlund took a bump? Yes, the 1990 Survivor Series when the giant egg hatched and he danced with the gobbledygooker in the ring. It's hard to forget something like that. Gene was running the ropes, and he intentionally tripped and fell on the bottom rope. At least I think it was intentional. I hope it was. I remember Roddy Piper on commentary. He was having fun, and all of a sudden when Gene tripped, Piper got all somber, and he wanted to make sure he was okay. And when he realized he was okay, he went back to having fun. I know Gene did a tag team match with Hulk Hogan once in the Twin Cities. It would have been back around 84. So I'm sure he probably took a bump somewhere in that match also. And he may have had a match. Didn't he have a match once in WCW with Mark Madden There was like something with him and Mark Madden back in like 2000. I don't know. I think back to the bump with the Gooker, though, at Survivor Series.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, we go back 51 years. January 24, 1963, the legendary Lou Thesz beat Buddy Rogers in Toronto to win the NWA World Heavyweight title. The promoters in the Northeast refused to recognize the title change because the match was only one fall at a time when all title matches were typically two out of three falls, and so as a result, they broke away from the NWA, formed a new group called the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, now WWE. The real reason for the split had to do with the fact that Vince McMahon Sr. and Toots Mont controlled Buddy Rogers' bookings, and they wanted to keep the NWA title in their territory. Other promotions were very upset over this, and that led to the split. So the one fall excuse was really just a cover reason. A few months later, Rogers was named WWF champion after winning a fictional tournament in Rio de Janeiro. It would not be the last fictional tournament in Rio that WWE used to crown a new champion. 30 years ago this week, on January 23rd, 1984, one of the most important dates in WWE history, the night Hulkamania was born. Hulkamania was already running wild in the AWA long before 1984, but this was the match that really launched his career, and it launched the Hogan-McMahon partnership, with Vince putting all of his marketing muscle behind Hogan, and it paid off. There was no bigger star or box office attraction in wrestling in the 80s than Hulk Hogan. And it was on this night, dubbed Super Monday at Madison Square Garden, that Hulk Hogan beat the Iron Sheik to win his first WWF championship, which he would not relinquish for another 4 years. Can you imagine if John Cena held the WWE title for four straight years today? People's heads would explode. 26 years ago this week, on January 24, 1988, this was a big day for wrestling as the NWA went live on pay-per-view from the Nassau Coliseum, which I just mentioned a moment ago. WWE Country, with its bunkhouse stampede, and things did not go too well for them. Number one, WWE countered them by airing the first Royal Rumble event live for free on the USA Network. This was only a couple of months after WWE debuted the first Survivor Series head-to-head on pay-per-view to counter Starrcade. And that pissed off all the cable companies to no end because they ended up with competing events on pay-per-view on the same night. So Survivor Series and Royal Rumble were both events that were born out of competition between the two companies and Vince's desire to try to put the NWA out of business. That really is their legacy. But it was just a disaster of a show for Crockett. A lot of the tickets were printed with the wrong start time on them, so you had people showing up to the arena just before the main event, which did not sit well with them, as you can imagine. And the entire show was less than 2 hours long. Dusty Rhodes won the Bunkhouse Stampede Steel Cage Battle Royal that night. Meanwhile, the Royal Rumble featured a contract signing between Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant for their big championship rematch on NBC a few weeks later, which is still, to this day, the most watched match in the history of American television. 33 million people tuned in to at least part of the show that night. The show on NBC, not the Rumble. Hacksaw Jim Duggan won the very first Royal Rumble match, which only had 20 participants instead of what would become the normal 30. The Jumping Bomb Angels also beat the Glamour Girls on the show in a 2-out-of-3 falls match to win the WWF Women's Tag Team titles. I really should go back and check that match out because I don't remember seeing it. I just remember the Jumping Bomb Angels were so freaking awesome to watch back in the day when I would actually see them. Maybe when the network launches, that'll be the first thing I go back and watch. Although, I guess technically this was not a pay-per-view, so I guess I probably won't be able to watch it when the network launches. I guess we'll see. 19 years ago this week, on January 22nd, 1995, Shawn Michaels won the shortest Royal Rumble match ever on pay-per-view, starting at number one and surviving 38 minutes until the very end. The first Rumble back in 88 that I just talked about only lasted 33 minutes, but that wasn't on pay-per-view, and that also had 20 guys instead of 30. Michaels became the first man ever to enter at number one and go all the way, and also gave us one of the best finishes in Rumble history, I think. We've seen a million copycats since, you know, dangling only a few inches off the floor, holding on for dear life before pulling yourself back in. But Shawn did it first, and he did it best. And they even played the Bulldog's music to make you think he really did win the match, but nope. Only 1 foot touched the floor, and Michaels rolled back in and knocked Davey Boy Smith off the ropes and out to the floor. Bob Holly and the 1-2-3 Kid also beat Bam Bam Bigelow and Tatanka to win the vacant tag team titles. This was the setup for the angle after the match where Bigelow shoved NFL legend Lawrence Taylor, who was in the front row laughing at Bam Bam after the loss. This set up a match between the two of them that headlined WrestleMania 11, which is one of the worst WrestleManias of all time. 18 years ago this week, on January 22nd, 1996, the night after the Royal Rumble on Monday Night Raw, Vader made his singles debut in the WWF, beating Savio Vega. He beat up Vega some more after the match was over until referees and WWF President Gorilla Monsoon came out to stop him. Monsoon ended up suspending Vader indefinitely for his actions, to which Vader responded by assaulting Monsoon while Vince McMahon freaked out on commentary. The reason they did this and suspended Vader right after his debut, because he had just showed up for the first time at the Rumble the night before, was because he needed some time off for shoulder surgery. And it was a great angle. The Vader-Jim Cornette dynamic very much reminds me of the Brock Lesnar-Paul Heyman dynamic today, in that, in this angle, Vader was the unstoppable monster, and not even his own manager could control him. Cornette did everything he could to hold Vader back, because he knew that Vader had evil intentions for Gorilla Monsoon, and he held Vader in the corner as long as he could until Vader could take no more, and he shoved Cornette aside, and he attacked him anyway. How many times have we seen Brock go nuts on TV, and Paul Heyman has to step in and calm him down just to prevent things from going too far? Many, many times. And it works. It just works. And finally, 14 years ago this week, on January 23rd, 2000, the WWE Royal Rumble pay-per-view from Madison Square Garden, one of the best Rumble pay-per-views of all time, we had the debut of Taz in WWE. This was when Kurt Angle came out, had a mystery opponent. Nobody knew who it was except the fact that everybody knew who it was. And Taz came out in New York City, in his hometown, got a huge reception. We talked earlier in the podcast here about Batista's reaction. It was good. It wasn't great. Well, Taz came out in the Garden. In the Garden, like Chicago and places like that, it's one of those buildings where you're almost guaranteed to get a big reaction if, let's say, somebody big is debuting or somebody big is coming back. And Taz was no exception. Everybody knew. They were just waiting. They were holding their breath. And when his music hit, they just went crazy. And he came out. He beat Kurt Angle, which was Kurt's first loss, although I think later on they determined that Taz used an illegal choke. So Kurt Angle was still technically undefeated until The Rock beat him a few weeks later. We had the Hardy Boys and the Dudley Boys' first ever table match on pay-per-view. We had the classic street fight between Triple H and Cactus Jack, which was the match, in my opinion, that put Triple H on the map as a true main event player. You know, I really didn't see him on that level until that night, until that match. I like this match a hell of a lot more than I like their Hell in a Cell match the month after. Unfortunately, this was also the same show that had the Miss Royal Rumble contest where Mae Young, God rest her soul, stripped down and took her top off and exposed herself to the world, and the censors that night were too slow, and they were trying to put things over her, you know, it was just terrible. So a small blemish on what was otherwise a great pay-per-view show 14 years ago this week, and that's This Week in Wrestling History. If you have questions for the mailbag, thesolemonster@gmail.com is the place to email me. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I will be live blogging during the Royal Rumble pay-per-view on Sunday night. Looking forward to seeing if I win in the Royal Rumble pool. I got number 26. So follow me on there. We're all over Facebook. I mentioned the group that you can apply for membership to. We have a profile page, a fan page, where you can like us. We're on YouTube as well. There's a brand new Sound Off Extra with my Raw review up there right now, in case you missed it, all 35 minutes of it. And we're on Stitcher Radio. Don't forget to please like us on Stitcher, stream us on Stitcher. Every time you do, it really helps us out in the rankings, so you can find us on there. We're in iTunes if you want to subscribe to us. And we have a free app in the Google Play Store. If you have an Android device, just type in Solemonster Sounds Off, and it should come right up. It is free. It works for most, not for all, but there's a million different ways that you can listen to the show, either via stream or download every single week. And don't forget, you can make a PayPal donation to the show on thesolemonster.com and get yourself a shout-out here on the show. So that about wraps it up here for this Royal Rumble edition of the Sound Off. I want to thank you for spending 90 minutes of your week with me. I very much appreciate that. If you are tuning into the Rumble pay-per-view, I think it's one of the few shows of the year that typically is fun. You know, some Rumbles are better than others, but, you know, we don't have too many pay-per-view events anymore that really are fun. And I still think of the Rumble as fun. And this will be the last Rumble, possibly the last Rumble untraditional pay-per-view, at least as we know it, before the network launches next month. So it's kind of historic in that way. But if you are tuning into the Rumble, do enjoy it. We'll have a live thread up on our Facebook profile page for The Sala Monster, which is my name on there. Again, I have said it before. It wouldn't let me put the word The in as a first name. That's why it's The. I always have people asking me, but that's the reason. So we'll have a thread going up on there if you want to participate and get involved in that. And next week, we'll be back with our Royal Rumble thoughts. So until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy the pay-per-view. We'll be back here with a new episode of The Sound Off, episode 312, right here next weekend, which may go up a day early because of the Super Bowl. I know everyone's pretty much going to be in Super Bowl mode next Sunday, not really Sound Off mode. So it's possible the show may go up about a day or so early. You'll want to watch out for that. So until then, take care, guys.
You've been listening to The Sala Monster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
You don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he can never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a break with Ace's name. I gotta get rid of this bastard. I gotta get this club. This club sucks.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Sala Monster Sounds Off.